Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower and we use words and phrases especially written for people learning English. On today's program, you will hear stories from Jonathan Evans and Alice Bryant. We end our program with an American story. This week, it is part 3 of Jack London's Love of Life. But first, Lebanese filmmaker Nadine Labaki has become the first female artist in the Arab world to be nominated for an Academy Award, or Oscar. Labaki directed the film Capernaum, a film about a Syrian refugee boy and a Kenyan baby who live without parents on the streets of Beirut. It was nominated for Best Foreign Language Film. Labaki will be one of the only female directors to compete for an Oscar this year. She told the Associated Press, "I wish there were a lot more women filmmakers this year represented, nominated in the Oscars. But I am sure in a few years we won't be having this problem anymore." Unlike in the West, women filmmakers are industry leaders in Lebanon. Capernaum is Labaki's third full-length film. In her home country, the 44-year-old mother of two children is a unifying figure among political and religious divisions. Labaki first became famous as a director of music videos for top Arab pop stars. Capernaum received a 15-minute standing ovation at this year's Cannes Film Festival. It won the Jury Prize, the third highest award given at Cannes. The United Nations has publicly praised the film. Lebanon's foreign minister said Capernaum put a Lebanese touch on the international film industry. The Oscar nomination of Capernaum is the second for Lebanon in 2 years in the foreign film group. It demonstrates the country's rising star power. Labaki called making the movie a life-changing experience. She said Capernaum helps humanize the real struggles of refugees only briefly talked about in the news. "We can't help but acknowledge that there is a fear of refugees in general around the world, and there are these walls we are building, and this fear that keeps growing," Labaki said. As she observed her small country struggling with a growing number of refugees, Labaki said she felt it was her duty to speak out against governments failing to deal with the crisis. Lebanon has one of the largest populations of Syrian refugees in the Arab world. "And their story is very painful," Labaki said. Both main characters in the film are refugees in real life. The Syrian child, Zane, has now found a home in Norway. And the young Kenyan, Jonas, has returned home. Labaki plans to make a documentary film on the lives of both children in the future. Capernaum will compete against 4 other films for the Oscar, including award season favorite Roma. Directed by Mexico's Alfonso Cuarón, it earned 10 Oscar nominations, including for Best Picture. The Academy Awards ceremony is Hollywood's biggest night of the year. It will be held on February 24th in Los Angeles, California.
British scientists are developing gene-edited chickens designed to be fully resistant to the influenza or flu virus. Wendy Barclay is one of the leaders of the gene-editing project. She is a professor of virology at Imperial College London. She said, the first chickens will be born later this year at the Roslin Institute at the University of Edinburgh in Scotland. The scientists are using a new gene-editing technology known as CRISPR to change the bird's DNA. The scientists removed parts of a protein on which the flu virus normally depends. That makes the chickens completely flu-resistant. Barclay said the idea is to produce birds that cannot get the flu and would form, in her words, a buffer between wild birds and humans. Health experts say the threat of a human flu pandemic is one of their biggest concerns. About 500,000 people died worldwide in the last large flu outbreak in 2009 and 2010. The historic 1918 Spanish flu killed around 50 million people. The greatest fear now is that a deadly form of flu could spread from wild birds into poultry and then into humans. The virus could then become an airborne form that can pass easily between people. If we could prevent influenza virus crossing from wild birds into chickens, we would stop the next pandemic, said Barclay. Barclay's team of scientists published their research in the journal Nature in 2016. They found that a gene present in chickens makes a protein that all flu viruses depend on to infect a host. Tests of cells created to not have the gene showed they cannot be infected with flu. Barclay said the plan is to use CRISPR to edit the chicken's DNA so that only one part of the protein is changed. The rest of the bird would be exactly the same as it was before. Barclay said poultry producers may have concerns about the public's opinions of gene-edited food. She said that people have been eating food from farmed animals that have been changed over many years by traditional breeding. But she added, they might be nervous about eating gene-edited food.
Teaching children social and emotional skills is getting new attention in the world of education. Some experts say doing arts and crafts at home and at school can help build those abilities. Mary Grace Berberian is an art therapist and social worker who teaches at New York University. She says that because the creative process requires invention and trial and error, children can learn to manage frustration through art. She says the creative process can also teach children to connect to the more emotional parts of themselves. Calls for social and emotional skills are coming from many areas, says Jacqueline Jodl. She directs the Aspen Institute's National Commission on Social, Emotional, and Academic Development. Families and parents are requesting help with social and emotional learning, she says. Teachers are also really starting to express demand for it. Jodl says the business community also continues to ask for students with a wider mix of skills than those traditionally taught at schools. In addition, an increasing number of young people are facing emotional challenges, says Melissa Schlinger. She is a vice president of the Collaborative for Academic, Social, and Emotional Learning, or CASEL, which is based in Chicago. CASEL does research, policy, and guidance work on social and emotional learning in schools. Schlinger says anxiety and depression are on the rise for young people. Experts suggest four ways to more purposefully combine social and emotional learning with children's art projects at home, school, or anywhere. Number one, think about the needs of the child when choosing materials. Art therapist Mary Grace Berberian notes that a child seeking control might gain something from beading or pencil drawing, for example. But a child who needs more freedom might learn more from working with paints or clay. Number two, give kids control over their projects. For example, Chicago-based arts organization Marwin gave a printmaking class in which students created small prints on what was important to them. Christian Ortiz supervises the art programs at Marwin. He suggested giving students the freedom to interpret a project through their own experience and viewpoints. Mary Grace Berberian advises parents not to control how a child does an art project at home. Instead, she suggests, ask kids about their creations and the decisions they made and why. Number three, create a lesson along with a project. Melissa Meller, who is with the Aspen Institute, remembers her young son doing an art project about learning from mistakes. The class read a book about a girl who turned a mistake into something beautiful. Then each student received a piece of paper with marks already on it. Their job was to use a drawing tool to turn it into a piece of art. The project aimed to teach flexibility, problem solving, creativity, and the ability to grow from mistakes. And number four, make art together. Mary Grace Berberian says when people work together in the creative process, they are mirroring each other and celebrating each other's artistic practice. In other words, it naturally builds understanding between them. I'm Alice Bryant. A house or a home? That is the question. How do we know when to use one or the other? In today's Ask a Teacher, we answer this question from one of our readers on Facebook. Hello, and thanks for asking. Both house and home are nouns that refer to living spaces. A house is a kind of building that people live in. Such buildings are often made for just one family. But a home is any kind of structure that people live in. It can be a house or apartment, a trailer, a boat, or something else. For example, my home is a small apartment in the city. The word home can also refer to a place where something is from or native to. Rainforests are home to countless bird species, for example. And Chicago is the home of deep dish pizza. Home can even refer to a sense of emotional belonging. We can say, being around family feels like home, or if you lived in a place and felt a strong emotional connection to it, you might say, for example, New York City will always be my home. Unlike house, we can also use home as an adverb. We mostly pair it with verbs of motion. For example, walk home, get home, go home, drive home, fly home, run home, and come home. But a few are unrelated to motion, such as stay home, call home, and be home. When home is an adverb, we almost never put words between the verb and home. I can say, for example, I'm flying home from Toronto Wednesday, or we stayed home last night. It was so cold out. These differences seem easy enough, right? The uncertainty between the two words probably comes when we use house informally. For instance, I can say, I'm at a friend's house, or I'm not leaving the house tonight. But we usually only use the word this way when we're talking about being at a house or leaving or staying in a house. In these statements, you can use house or home. I stayed home last night, and I stayed in the house last night. The meaning is the same. In other words, home is a little more flexible than house. You can stay home or stay in the house. You can also go home or come home, but you cannot go house or come house. And that's Ask a Teacher. I'm Alice Bryant.
Love of Life by Jack London. Part 3.
The man had brought his gun half the distance to his shoulder before he realized what he was doing. He lowered it and drew his hunting knife from its cover. Before him was meat and life. He ran his finger along the edge of the knife. It was sharp. The point was sharp. He would throw himself on the bear and kill it. But his heart began its pounding. Then came its wild leap, and he began to feel faint. His wild courage was replaced by a great fear. In his weakness, what if the animal attacked him? He drew himself up tall, grasping the knife and staring hard at the bear. The bear advanced a couple of steps and stood up. If the man ran, the bear would run after him. But the man did not run. He was alive now with the courage of fear. The bear moved away to one side with a threatening noise. He himself was fearful of this strange creature that appeared unafraid. But the man did not move. He stood still until the danger was past. Then he yielded to a fit of trembling and sank to his knees on the wet grass. He regained control of himself and then started to move forward, afraid now in a new manner. It was not the fear that he would die from lack of food. He was afraid that he would be destroyed by forces other than starving. There were the wolves. Across the wasteland, their howls could be heard, making the air itself a threat most real to him. Now and again the wolves in groups of two and three crossed his path, but they stayed away from him. They were not in sufficient numbers to attack, and besides, they were hunting caribou. Caribou did not battle. while this strange creature that walked on two legs might bite. In the afternoon he came upon scattered bones where the wolves had made a kill. What remained had been a young caribou an hour before. He studied the bones, cleaned of any flesh. They were still pink with the life in them, which had not yet died. Might he look like that before the day was done? Was this life a fleeting thing without meaning? It was only life that pained. There was no hurt in death. To die was to sleep. It meant rest. Then why was he not content to die? But he did not think about these things for very long. He was soon seated in the grass, a bone in his mouth, biting at the bit of life that made it yet pink. The sweet, meaty taste drove him mad. He closed his teeth firmly on the bones. Sometimes it was the bone that broke, sometimes his teeth. Then he crushed the bones between the rocks. He pounded them into tiny pieces and ate them. He was in such a hurry that he pounded his fingers, too. He felt surprised at the fact that his fingers did not hurt much when they were caught under the rock. Then came frightful days of snow and rain. He did not know when he made camp and when he broke camp. He traveled in the night as much as in the day. He rested whenever he fell, moving ahead whenever the dying life in him started up again. He, as a man, no longer struggled. It was the life in him, unwilling to die, that drove him on. He did not suffer, nor feel pain. But his mind was filled with hallucinations and wild dreams. But he still ate the crushed bones of the young caribou, which he had gathered and carried with him. He crossed no more hills, but followed a large stream which flowed through a wide valley. He did not see this stream, nor this valley. He saw nothing except hallucinations. One morning he awakened with his mind clear, lying on his back on a rocky surface. The sun was shining bright and warm. Far away he heard the noises made by the young caribou. He remembered rain and wind and snow. But whether he had been beaten by the storm for 2 days or 2 weeks, he did not know. For some time he lay without movement. The friendly sun poured down upon him and filled his body with its warmth. A fine day, he thought. Perhaps he could succeed in locating himself. By a painful effort, he rolled on his side. Below him flowed a wide river. Its unfamiliarity puzzled him. Slowly he followed it with his eyes as it curved among the bare hills. They were more bare and lower than any hills he had yet seen. Slowly, without excitement, he followed the course of the strange stream toward the skyline and saw that it emptied into a bright and shining sea. He was still unexcited. Most unusual, he thought. It was probably a trick of his mind. He was certain of this when he also saw a ship floating in the shining sea. He closed his eyes for a while, then opened them. It was strange how the sight continued, yet it was not strange. He knew there were no seas or ships in the middle of this land, as he had known there was no cartridge in the empty gun. He heard a noise behind him. It seemed like the dry sound that comes from the throat when air is forced out in a cough. Very slowly, because of his weakness and stiffness, he rolled to his other side. He could see nothing near, but he waited patiently. Again came the cough, and there, between two rocks, he saw the gray head of a wolf. The sharp ears did not stand up as straight as he had seen them on other wolves. The eyes were dull, and the head seemed to hang. The animal opened and shut its eyes frequently in the sunshine. It seemed sick. As he looked, it coughed again. This was real, he thought. He turned on the other side to see the reality of the world which had been hidden from him before by his hallucination. But the sea still shone, and the ship was still there. Was it reality? He closed his eyes for a long while and thought. And then he remembered. He had been traveling north by east, away from the Deese Divide and into the Coppermine Valley. This wide river was the Coppermine. That shining sea was the Arctic Ocean. That ship was a fishing boat which had wandered east from the mouth of the Mackenzie River. Now it was lying in Coronation Gulf. He remembered the map that he had seen long ago, and it was all clear and reasonable to him. He sat up and turned his attention to immediate affairs. He had worn holes through the blanket wrappings, and his feet were like shapeless pieces of meat. His last blanket was gone. His gun and knife were both lost. He had also lost his hat somewhere, with the matches and the band. The matches against his chest were safe and dry inside the paper. He looked at his watch. It marked 11 o'clock and was still going. This proved that he had kept it wound. He was calm. Although very weak, he had no feeling of pain. He was not hungry. The thought of food was not even pleasant to him. Whatever he did was done entirely by reasoning. He tore off the legs of his trousers to the knees and bound them about his feet. Somehow he had succeeded in keeping the tin container. He would have some hot water before he began what he knew was to be an awful journey to the ship. His movements were slow. He shook as if with a disease. When he started to gather dried grasses, he found he could not rise to his feet. He tried again and again. Then he contented himself with moving about on his hands and knees. Once he went near the sick wolf. The animal dragged itself out of the way, licking its face with a tongue which seemed hardly to have the strength to curl. The man noticed that the tongue was not the customary healthy red, but was a yellowish-brown and covered with a half-dried coating. After he drank some hot water, the man found he was able to stand. He could even walk as well as a dying man might be supposed to walk. But every minute or two he was forced to rest. His steps were unsteady, as were the steps of the wolf behind him. That night, when the shining sea was hidden in the blackness, he knew he was nearer to it by no more than 4 miles. Through the night he heard the cough of the sick wolf, now and then the noises of the young caribou. There was life all around him, but it was strong life, very much alive and well. He knew the sick wolf was following the sick man's steps in the hope that the man would die first. In the morning, when he opened his eyes, he saw it looking at him with a hungry stare. It stood with its tail between its legs like an unhappy dog. The sun rose brightly, and all morning the man headed toward the ship on the shining sea. The weather was perfect. It was the brief return of summer which was usual in that country. Might continue for a week, or tomorrow or the next day it might be gone.
And that's our program for today. We will be back tomorrow with more stories and information from around the world. I'm Ashley Thompson. Thanks for listening.